You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. We're about to mark the 100th anniversary of one of the greatest maritime disasters ever, the Halifax explosion, when two ships collided in Halifax Harbor. The resulting explosion was the biggest man-made blast prior to the atomic bomb. Some 2,000 people killed and many thousands more were injured. Yet this cataclysmic event is largely forgotten, at least here on the U.S. side of our border with Canada. But John U. Bacon is changing that with his latest book, The Great Halifax Explosion, a World War I story of treachery, tragedy, and extraordinary heroism. Welcome now, not wearing your Michigan Radio Sports commentator hat, but your New York Times best-selling author hat.
Well, thank you very much.
You know, we have talked about your books exploring football and, you know, Michigan sports programs and the mental health struggles of your friend, the late John Saunders of ESPN. Now for something completely different, the Great Halifax Explosion. What turned your attention to this?
Two things. The two sides of my family, the Bacons, were in New York throughout the whole process, the last 200 years. The other side, the Canadian side, went north to New Brunswick. My grandfather was 12 years old in 1917 when this happened. I used to spend my summers in New Brunswick talking to him. He kept on telling me about this, you know, two-ton anchor that went 2 miles this way, another part that went 3 miles that way. And I didn't know what he was talking about. I didn't think he was crazy, but I never heard of it anywhere else until 1999, when I'm researching my first book on the history of University of Michigan hockey. It turns out Michigan's first hockey coach happens to have been a first responder, if you will, to the Halifax explosion. And that's what inspired him to become a doctor, go to U of M, and start Michigan's hockey program.
So you started digging and digging.
I did, and I got lucky and lucky because it turns out his papers, his letters, Joseph Barge was a great letter writer, and his grandchildren, who are here in the state, and I know them, they've got his letters from World War I, where he served for a year and ended up getting hit with a shell and handicapped for a little while and overcame that. His letters from Halifax and his letters from the University of Michigan, and I just got really, really lucky.
All right, talk about this explosion, December 6th, 1917, in Halifax Harbor. When you think about how big was it? Can you put that into context for us?
Yeah, this always stuns people that they had 6 million pounds of TNT and other high explosives on this ship. That's a bad idea. That is 13 times the weight of the Statue of Liberty on one ship. So you should not do that in the first place, but they were desperate. It's 1917. The Russians have left the war, so now the Eastern Front has been conceded to the Germans, and they're paranoid of the Germans rolling over the British, the French, and now the Americans who just joined the war. So you're overdoing this. Then, of course, you bump into another ship in Halifax Harbor. That's a bad idea. A fire starts. The crew takes off for the other shore, so no one is warned. And this ghost ship, now burning, slides perfectly into Pier 6 at the base of Halifax at 8:46 a.m. So people are walking to work, they're walking to school, the school children take a detour and go to watch this thing. Thousands are watching the ship burn, and at 9:04:35, it finally explodes. And in 1/15th of a second, less time than it takes to blink, half of Halifax is gone. 25,000 are homeless, about half the city. 9,000 are wounded, 2,000 are dead in a split second. It was 1/5 the power of the atomic bomb dropped on Hiroshima. And we know that because Oppenheimer, who's the master behind the atomic bomb, he studied this at a conference at Cal Berkeley in 1942. It's the only other comparison they had for the A-bomb. So that's how serious this was. That's the horrible news. And the great news happens afterwards.
Indeed. Getting back to where we were historically, as you say, World War I had been going on for more than 3 years. The U.S. had entered the fight that spring of 1917. How key was Halifax to the war effort?
Halifax was the conduit for almost everything from North America going to the Great War. That includes Americans and Canadian soldiers, almost all materials, food, supplies, munitions, relief supplies, you name it. Almost any British soldier not already in Britain was going to go through Halifax, as well as the Americans. So that was a crucial, arguably the most crucial port during World War I.
And history happens when you get two entities winding up in the same place at the same time, that one in a million thing. In this case, two ships, the SS Mont Blanc and the SS Emo. Now, tell us about them and why they were in Halifax Harbor that fateful morning.
Mont Blanc was going to Bordeaux, France, to turn that 6 million pounds of explosives into shells to bomb Germans.
And
basically,
as you say, loaded beyond the gills with incredible explosives to the point where the captain said nobody can light a cigarette.
No one can even hold a match in your pocket. That's how terrified they were. They lined the hull with plywood to make sure there's no metal-on-metal contact because they knew that one spark could send them up. they secured the holds with copper nails because copper is one of the few metals that does not spark when struck. They feared that one spark, one rub, could send them all up. They lined their shoes, their boots, with canvas covers to make sure they didn't spark. So these guys in the ship knew that this was a floating time bomb, basically.
So they were pulling into Halifax Harbor?
They were pulling into Halifax Harbor, and they think after 4 days by themselves, no convoy, from New York, Brooklyn, New York, to Halifax, they think, okay, finally we're safe. Relax. And they went through not one, but two metal gates underwater, which kept the U-boats, the German submarines, out of the harbor. So you're finally in. You're dying to get in here. It's 8:45 in the morning. The Emo, the Norwegian relief ship, was already a day late because of the same fences. The fences kept them from getting out the night before. So they're in a rush to go out. That captain is a hothead, which we make clear in this thing. So he's a problem, and he does not have any idea what Mont Blanc has on it.
Why is that? You'd think there would be warning flags.
One warning flag means the German U-boats just outside Halifax Harbor have you as a sitting duck. So about five guys in the whole harbor had any idea what was on the ship.
Okay. So
there's your problem.
There's your problem, because it really is a Murphy's Law.
One thing after the other. And safeguards, some of them stupidly, the protocols were removed because, you know, they're in a haste. It's World War I. Guys are dying overseas, left and right. So the British Crown did not care that much what's happening in Halifax. They're worried about their guys getting mowed over in the trenches of Europe.
Isn't this a big harbor? How did these two wind up bumping up?
It's a big harbor, except for one part called the Narrows, which are in fact narrow. It's all of a sudden only 1,000 feet across for about a mile, 18-mile long harbor. It's the second biggest natural harbor to Sydney, Australia. It's a great harbor. But now you've got two ships trying to get out, get past each other, in this 1,000-foot-wide narrows, and the one ship, the Emo, keeps on ignoring the rules and going to the left and to the left and to the left of each successive ship. This is the same as driving a car on a two-lane road. You want to pass on the left, you better know what you're doing, because there'll be a car coming by on the right. That car, in this case, was Mont Blanc.
Oh, boy. So they bump.
They bump. It's a game of chicken, and finally, at the last second, Mont Blanc says this guy's crazy, and he's not going to get on the correct side. So they try to peel off the last second, as we would on the highways, and try to peel off left. So does the Emo at the last second. So they bump, and it's not a big bump, but it's the big enough bump to knock over the airplane fuel on top. They had unwittingly constructed the perfect bomb with a fuse on top and the heavy explosives down below.
So it starts to burn. And the crew of the Mont Blanc, as you say, they knew what was going on. They got off that ship and paddled to safety, didn't they?
They had two rowboats, 20 people each, and they went the other direction to Dartmouth, Nova Scotia, across the Narrows.
And so here's this ghost ship.
This ghost ship now, which no one knows what's on it.
And the whole town's like, there's a ship burning. I can just see
burning.
This. Let's go see.
It's exciting. And the war seems so far away, they don't imagine what's on it. And the timing is cruel, like I said, because everyone's going to work and to school. The stoves from breakfast are still burning in every home in Halifax, which is going to matter.
And the kind of explosion, I mean, you take us to that moment. Give us a for instance. You have so many victims of this explosion. What story really hit you hard?
As far as the power of it, my grandfather's story on the 2,000-pound anchor being flown 2 miles, that got my attention. Windows were blown out 50 miles away. And again, the whole town is just flattened. If you were standing within a quarter mile of it, you were flown a quarter mile up the hill, and you had no idea what just happened to you. But all of a sudden, you're at a new park, Needham Park, on the top of the hill of Halifax. So you're watching it 1 second. Next second, you've got black grime all over you. You're wet from the tidal wave that happens afterwards, a 35-foot tidal wave, which drowned those who survived, the first thing. And no one can believe what's happening. And the look of bewilderment was repeated often by people. No one was screaming or yelling. They're walking around like zombies. Like, what has just happened?
And people vanished, didn't they? Some of them. Never to be found. No
trace.
There are
about 600 people we have no idea what happened to.
What kind of injuries, John, were most common?
Sad to say, facial wounds. Because the town, it's like a miniature San Francisco. They got these beautiful homes, two-story homes, with bay windows. Because the bay is beautiful, so they've all faced the bay. Everyone went to the bay windows and their workshops and so on to watch the Mont Blanc burn. Back then, there's no safety glass. This is the thin-paned stuff. So when they're watching, the facial wounds occur. About 300 or 400 were blinded during this process. And my great aunt, Aunt Ruth, lived in Halifax for a while. And you were taught when you grew up in Halifax in the 20s and 30s, if you see somebody with one of these blue-tinged facial scars, that's from the TNT itself, you are told to not stare because that's the explosion. So this went on for decades.
There was, amidst all of this disaster, you bring us some very special moments of human kindness, including a barbershop story.
And what's great about this is obviously a disaster you're never going to forget, but they remember the human kindness as much as anything else. And one beautiful little example among many in this book, Noble and Gordon Driscoll, 10 and 12 at the time, they go about an hour away for a haircut, because that's what we have to go for a haircut. That's where they're recovering. Mom gives them $1 to go in for a haircut. This is a week after the disaster. Okay. They still have glass shards, little bits of glass and wood in the back of their heads. So the barbers are cutting their hair and trying to get the oil out of their hair, which is very stubborn. And when the kid winces, when Noble winces, the barber says, "Ah, you must be from Halifax." He knows immediately. He goes over to the other barber and they whisper to each other, unbeknownst to the two kids. They go back and tell all the other customers, "We're not open today, gotta go away." They give the kids two shampoos to make sure they get the oil out. They pull out all the little glass shards and wooden chips. And afterwards, Noble's getting very nervous because all he has is a dollar, and that will not pay for two shampoos and all the extra attention. He gives the barber a dollar, feeling embarrassed and a bit sheepish. And the barber waves it off and smiles. And with the other barber, they go across the street to a clothing store and buy the kids a new wardrobe because all their clothes are gone, except for what they're wearing. So, and 80 years later, what we remember is the barber. 100 years later now, that barber whose name I don't know, but that act of kindness lives on forever. And I think that's really, really cool.
I'm speaking with John Eubacon about his latest book, The Great Halifax Explosion, a World War I story of treachery, tragedy, and extraordinary heroism. And let's talk about that heroism, just like we saw after 9/11 when people and nations really came together, put aside differences to stand as one against a tragedy. There really was a coming together after the Halifax explosion, wasn't there?
No question. And it's true heroism. It really is. And it's from everybody. It's common people doing uncommon things. Just your neighbor all of a sudden going down into a basement to save a neighbor's baby. It is soldiers going into burning homes to get cats out, for crying out loud. It's again and again and again. The extraordinary heroism came from ordinary people. And we saw a lot of this during 9/11. This is on actually a grander scale because those are two towers that the firemen go up and that's about it. This is all over town. This goes on for about a day and a half, this endless burning. So a 14-year-old girl is one of our heroes. Joseph Barge, we'll get to, is one of our heroes as well. And it's really inspiring. So those of you who are tired of disasters, it's about a quarter of it is set up. Middle third or so is the explosion. And then the last, whatever that leaves, my math
yes.
is off, almost a third or so, more than a third, is how the city and the people responded, including the Americans.
Yes, because there were testy relations, as you point out. We get a good history lesson into the formation of Canada, and things were a little testy, but particularly the city of Boston stepped up.
Really quite amazing. And look, I grew up with more Canadian history than most, given my mom being a Canadian native. I had no idea that we were not allies at all in 1917. In 1776, when the start of the war, that side of my family, including 60,000 other American colonists, went to New Brunswick and Nova Scotia. The American side of me calls them the scaredy cats.
Yeah.
The Canadian side is the United Empire Loyalists.
That's right.
So they basically founded New Brunswick and Nova Scotia, essentially. So they had no great feelings towards the U.S. In 1812, it's the Canadians versus the Americans, essentially, as well as the British, of course. The guy tried to burn down the presidential mansion, and he failed. He tried to burn it down, but it's made of white stucco,
yeah.
So you can't get very far with it. But it blackened it, and that forced them to whitewash it, which is why it's called the White House. That guy is buried with honor in the center of Halifax. So, and then you got Joseph Barge, the world's greatest privateer at the time in Canada. He sunk, captured, or burned more than 60 American ships, the most wanted man in America. And he was finally caught in Portsmouth, New Hampshire, where they walked him up and down Main Street and fed him hardtack for 2 months.
A perp walk.
A perp walk. Yeah, the world's first perp walk, probably, I suppose. So we were not allies, even in the Civil War. Half of Halifax supported the Confederates, and with great danger they did so, because they wanted the cotton. In 1911, I can't believe this either, the Speaker of the House of the United States, the Paul Ryan of his day, got on the floor of U.S. Congress to vociferously advocate for the annexation of Canada, and he received cheers and a glowing report from the Washington Post. 1911, American leaders were talking about annexing Canada. So we are not allies.
But Boston stepped up to a point where it's even recognized today.
It is recognized today in no small terms. Boston, they're still shipping towns. And even though they're at war for basically 100 years, when it happened, the Massachusetts governor, Samuel McCall, without even being asked, they send two trains, two ships, 100 doctors, 300 nurses, all the supplies you could ever imagine to run a couple hospitals for a few weeks at about $1 million of supplies, which is $20 million a day, without being asked. And you talk to any of the survivors in the 70s or 80s, late in their life, the first thing they always mentioned was the help from Boston. and had turned, by the way, U.S. and Canada into allies. That's where it starts. The Halifax is so appreciative. To this day, they spent $180,000 to find their best spruce tree in the entire province, 50 feet high or so. Usually a private citizen. They've got a cutting ceremony. They load it on a truck. They send it 600 miles down to Boston. They raise it in Boston Common for the holidays. They light it in a big ceremony. It costs them $180,000, and no Bostonians or very few have any idea why they're being thanked. But as a Haligonian, as they're called, said, they said, why should we stop thanking them? Which to me is such a great spirit and so counter to what we see internationally right now.
Indeed.
This is how people are supposed to get along.
And other things too. Medicine? There were medical advances made because of what was encountered in the aftermath?
Ophthalmology, eye surgery was greatly advanced because all these doctors in town who spread best practices, and as I said, there are hundreds of blinded people from Halifax. Pediatric surgery. A guy named Dr. Ladd from Boston came up and he realized during the burn victims, the kid burn victims in Halifax, that you have to approach this differently than you do adult burn victims for various reasons. He goes back to Boston, has a 2-bed clinic, and from that he gets a whole wing. Talk to any pediatric surgeon, and they'll tell you the father of pediatric surgery is Dr. Ladd, and he learned it in Halifax.
And then, astoundingly, the Great Halifax Explosion, as you say, has a direct connection to men's hockey at the University of Michigan.
This is my favorite of the stories, as you might imagine.
I can guess.
But,
yeah, all things do come down to University of Michigan.
Of course
athletics.
They do. Why shouldn't they? But that privateer I mentioned, yes, who sunk 60 and burned and captured 60 American ships, his great-grandson also grew up not liking Americans too much. He fought in World War I. He's all gung-ho about it. He got hit with a shell, came back to learn how to walk again in Halifax when the boat blew up. And he knows first aid. So by the end of the weekend, he is basically performing surgeries he has no business performing, but it's all hands on deck, 9,000 wounded.
Because he'd been on the battlefield in World
exactly.
War I.
Exactly, so, and you got 9,000 wounded, so what can you do?
Yeah.
That's when he realizes, I don't want to be a businessman in Montreal, which he was, making good money. I don't want to be a soldier. I don't want to be a pastor like my father. I want to be a doctor. I want to heal people, not kill them. And his uncle gives them $100 and says, go to the University of Michigan. And I'm not quite sure why. His cousin was there in surgery, so perhaps that was it. He comes to Ann Arbor. He marries a woman from Battle Creek, an American. He becomes an American citizen because the Bostonians so impressed him. He said, I've changed my view forever about Americans based on Boston. Becomes a citizen, goes down to Fielding Yost's office, the athletic director at the time, and says, you need a hockey program. He said, only if you're the first coach. So while a med school student, while married, he starts the hockey program. It has now won 9 national titles, which is a national record. It starts with the Halifax Explosion.
This is an extraordinary book, John Eubakin's book, The Great Halifax Explosion, a World War I story of treachery, tragedy, and extraordinary heroism. And it officially comes out tomorrow, November 7th. And he'll be speaking about the book at Rackham Auditorium on the University of Michigan campus tomorrow night, Tuesday the 7th at 7 p.m., presented by Literati Bookstore. And I will have the pleasure of introducing my friend and New York Times bestselling author. So it ought to be a good night. There's no charge for tickets. And you can register by going to Literati's Facebook page. You put a lot of work, a lot of time into telling this story, and I can tell it has really grabbed you and moved you.
It has, and even writing it, I got choked up a few times. People have already read it in the early going, you included, have gotten choked up a few times. It's a story about disaster, but how people respond to the disaster, and these people ended up living very good lives. That's incredible. They lost, you know, 5 siblings, and it's horrible, obviously. And they find ways to pick themselves up. And people who have interviewed them say they have such great perspective. They are so patient. This is before they passed away, obviously, in the 70s and 80s. And they're so good-hearted. And that's the lesson of this whole thing, is that no matter what happens to you in this world, somehow they have found a way to live good, productive, contributing lives.
A lesson for the ages. John Eubakin, thank you so much.
Thank you.